Coming to you from one of the few western states not totally besieged by wildfires right now, this is Go West Young Podcast, the show about the outdoors and America's public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities, recording this week at 8,300 feet, just outside of Denver. In a minute, we're going to talk to the guy who visited all of the national monuments in the West that are being threatened by President Trump and Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. That is one heck of a road trip. We're going to ask Brent Rose what he learned on the way. But first, let's talk about the news. Even here in Colorado, it has been smoky all week. We've got a couple fires burning out in the western part of the state, but that is nothing compared to what folks in the Northwest and Montana are dealing with right now. You know, I lived in Oregon for a decade, so watching the Eagle Creek fire in the Columbia River Gorge is just devastating to me. My friends who grew up in Montana feel the same way about the fires up there, especially the Sprague fire that burned down the historic Sperry Chalet in Glacier National Park. And here's the thing that gets me. As we record this on a Friday afternoon, we have three hurricanes churning in the Atlantic at once. We're in the midst of one of the worst wildfire seasons in Western history, and it is only early September. All this, of course, is completely consistent with what climate scientists have been warning about for years. Hotter, drier summers fueling huge fires on land, and warmer oceans fueling huge storms out at sea. This is, it appears, the new normal. And we need to be planning for it in our parks and forests and cities, which is why it's so tragic that Ryan Zinke and the Trump administration are doing the exact opposite of that. Back in August, the Interior Department quietly killed an order that was issued during the Obama administration that told park managers to consider climate change as they planned for the future. That's a totally reasonable thing to do, right? But that order is gone now. And Secretary Zinke himself even admitted that fires like this are, quote, the new normal. That is a direct quote from a report on the deadly fires that burned through and out of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park last year. The takeaway from that report was that no one at the Park Service had even imagined a wildfire like that with 90-mile-an-hour winds. They didn't think that was even possible at Great Smoky Mountains. Secretary Zinke told reporters that that fire was bigger than anyone could have imagined. But just days before that, he killed the policy that told park managers to start imagining and preparing exactly for scenarios like that. Then, just a few hours after he issued that report on the Great Smoky Mountains fire, Sperry Chalet burned down in Glacier National Park in Ryan Zinke's home state of Montana. Again, firefighters did all they could. They had pumps and hoses. They'd wrapped as much of the lodge as they could in fire-resistant material. And it wasn't enough, because this is the new normal. So the superintendent of Glacier is a guy named Jeff Mao. He knows all this. He's given TED Talks about it. And he has already been sidelined by Secretary Zinke. Earlier in the summer, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, went to Glacier National Park. The park, of course, was thrilled about this. Zuckerberg is in the midst of giving away billions of dollars, and part of a park superintendent's job is showing potential donors around. But Ryan Zinke's staff in Washington stepped in. They told Jeff Mao, an expert on climate change, that he couldn't meet with Mark Zuckerberg. They also kicked the top USGS climate scientists at Glacier National Park off that tour. And when Zuckerberg visited, park staff was banned from sharing his posts on Facebook. So the Washington Post this week got a hold of emails leading up to Zuckerberg's visit. They showed Ryan Zinke's staff finally relented on one thing. Mark Zuckerberg would be allowed to meet Gracie the Bark Ranger. Gracie is a dog that keeps mountain goats away from the tourists. Despite Ryan Zinke's best efforts to keep Mark Zuckerberg from learning about the effects of climate change at Glacier National Park, the CEO posted about it anyway, pointing out, and I'm quoting here, "In the last 100 years, the average global temperature has risen 1.5 degrees. But in the high elevations of Montana, where Glacier is, the temperature is warming at 3 times the global average, enough to melt glaciers." Mark Zuckerberg acknowledges the threat climate change poses to our public lands. Ryan Zinke, on the other hand, appears to be taking a cue from the Roman Emperor Nero, fiddling while our parks burn. Our guest this week is a journalist, activist, host, and he has spent the last 2 years living in a really kick-ass van documenting his travels all across the country. This summer, he visited 22 of the national monuments that are being threatened by Secretary Zinke and President Trump. Brent Rose, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So how'd this idea come about anyway, to try to hit all of these monuments basically at once?
You know, I'd been, like you said, I've been driving around for about 2 years, and I'd been looking for ways to make the trip more than just about myself and about, you know, adventure and exploration and stuff. I wanted to find a way to reach people and give back. And I was driving through Nevada one day, and I was just thinking about things. I could do something for the environment. All right, well, maybe something with national parks. National parks are okay right now, theoretically. Oh, wait, but didn't I hear something about national monuments? And so I pulled over at a rest stop and Googled it and realized that that the monuments, Trump's monuments order had gone through and that it was right in the middle of the evaluation period already. And it just didn't seem to be on anybody's radar. I mean, I consider myself fairly keyed into to various issues like this, and it wasn't on my radar at all. And I talked to a couple friends, and they had no idea either. So it got me thinking, well, how could I get this in front of more people and get a few more eyeballs on it and just make people understand? Because the public comment period was open at that time, and we just wanted to get as many signatures as possible. So I kind of looked at the map and I realized they were almost all of them were on the western half of the U.S. And here I am, you know, I'm already a reporter. I've already got cameras. I've already got a high-tech van with Wi-Fi and stuff like that. This seems like my van was like custom built for a mission like this. So within an hour or two of thinking it up, I decided that's what I was going to do for the month. And threw together a quick website called 27monuments.org, and threw up a Facebook page and stuff like that for it as well, and just hit the road. And it ended up being 6,500 miles of driving in about 3 weeks, and you know, a short video from each of the monuments, basically just to get them on people's radar and get people to see how unique and how special these places are. And so they don't sort of lump them all together. Because I think if we can't visualize them, then it's hard to connect to them on an emotional level. And I really wanted to make a connection between people and them.
So where did you start out? Where were you when this kind of bolt of lightning hit?
So I was working on a story in Colorado at the time. And that's when I was putting it all together. And then my first stop was Rio Grande del Norte, which is in northern New Mexico, and then went down to, oh boy, it's been a minute here. You're gonna have to forgive me a second.
Pull up the map again so you can remember.
Yeah, seriously, I should pull up my website. Where did I go from there?
Arizona, wasn't it?
And then right. From there, I went further south. No, to Oregon Mountains, Desert Peaks.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then over to Canyons of the Ancients and Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, sort of through the Utah ones, and then down into Arizona. And that's right when that crazy June heat wave hit, that record-breaking heat wave. So I was doing one in Nevada, and it was 115 degrees. Ooh. And I was like, I got to get out of here. Yeah. So I'd had a friend who works for a data mapping company, Esri, kind of put together the mathematically most efficient route between all of the monuments. So I was following that, and I called him. I was like, hey, can we find the second most efficient route that gets me out of the Southwest right now? And luckily it only added about 200 miles to the journey to turn north and head up into Idaho and Montana and then over into Washington and down the West Coast. And by the time we got back into to the Southwest to get those last ones that we'd missed, it was a nice cool 104, 105 degrees instead of 115. So we made the right call.
Having grown up in Tucson, there's actually a huge difference between 105 and 115. It really is all the difference in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it made a major difference.
So let's go back to bear's ears then. We've talked a lot about it on this podcast. We've heard a lot about it, but everyone mm-hmm. seems to have a different take for them on what makes that area so special.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it isn't just one thing. That's kind of the thing about Bear's Ears, is that it's so many things. So, I mean, to start with, you've got this stunning natural beauty, you know, these Valley of the Gods and just these incredible natural rock formations that just, I mean, they look like you're in a cathedral on another planet. There's also just incredible cultural and archaeological connection to it. So this is, that land is special to many different Native American nations. And to get Bear's Ears designated, unprecedented collaboration between five Native American nations came together and worked on that very publicly and very in the open for years to get that designation pushed through. And then you contrast that with what's happening with Ryan Zinke's and Trump's review process, and it's all behind closed doors. We have no idea what their criteria is or how it works. We do know that when he was in Utah, he spent 4 days meeting with oil and gas companies and with the politicians who are trying to reverse the designation. In fact, the politicians who got us into this mess in the first place. But he only spent 1 hour with that tribal coalition that was responsible for getting Bear's Ears made. So 1 hour versus 4 days when you're supposed to be impartial. So so that's kind of what we're up against here. It's it's very clear favoritism toward one side. And it's a real shame because this place has, you know, just unbelievable petroglyphs and ancient dwellings that were just built into cliff sides. And when I walked through there, that was kind of one of the first times that the history really hit me and the import of this mission that I'd kind of gotten into on a whim, honestly, was really driven home for me. I realized just how special and how important these places were and how we really need to fight to keep them safe.
Of these 22 monuments, which mm-hmm. one surprised you the most?
I mean, Canyon of the Ancients was incredible. It really blew me away, and I wasn't expecting... I didn't know what I was expecting from it. I kind of went in with fewer expectations, and that's got the most... it's like the densest concentration of archaeological sites anywhere in the U.S. And it's just unbelievable. You know, these multi-story dwellings and pueblos that still exist there that you can walk through. And the sense of history you get there is amazing. And also, just on a personal note, I got one of my favorite photos I've ever taken in my life was there when I went to an old dwelling at about midnight or 1 a.m. and managed to get the Milky Way rising over it, which was just a really special thing for me.
I think that's one of those things that folks who live in cities or particularly live back east don't really grasp the difference of what it is to look at the sky at night in some of these remote spots and how that changes you.
It really does. I mean, it gives you a sense of your place in the universe, you know, beyond. It makes you feel very small, but somehow connected to the rest of the world, I think, and to the rest of the people in it. I mean, it's just amazing. And that is true. That one of the characterizing features of these national monuments is that almost without exception, they're very rugged. Like, these are not your national parks that everything's paved and you kind of drive up to the thing you want to look at and, you know, you go stick your head in and there it is. And then you get back on the road and drive to the next thing. And not to knock that, because I think national parks are incredibly important and they're some of my favorite places in the world. But some of these national monuments literally don't have a single paved road inside them. So these are these sort of rugged, rough and tumble places. But that in itself is such a special and rare thing these days. There are very few natural wild places that you can go that show you what it was like to walk in these same places, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of years ago, and more or less they remain unchanged. So the idea that these places could then be logged or drilled for oil or mined for coal or otherwise developed, it really shakes you up a little bit when you actually have your feet there and you realize how special and ancient these places are.
Obviously, hitting 6,000 miles in 3 weeks, I'm sure you didn't have tons of time to stop and chat. But were there any really interesting people you met along the way while you were doing this?
Yeah, I met some really cool people. Just at my, my very first stop, I just went and started talking to a ranger. And as soon as they found out what I was doing, they really opened up and they said, oh, well, okay, you've only got this much time. All right, we'll take you here. You got to go over there. These are some things that you might want to know. And, it fed me all this information that I ended up using for the video that I did for that one. And then the second one I went to, Oregon Mountains, Desert Peaks, somebody had seen the first one I did, who lives down there, and he reached out and said, "Hey, we're trying to get the local Conservation Act going. Would you like to come and check this out? We'll take you around and show you the things you need to show you need to see, and we'll take you all like off the beaten path places." This is a guy named Chris Lang. And I showed up, and he and his friends were there, and we went around, and I got to see these caves and climb these mountains that I normally wouldn't have been able to see. And he's able to give me a real sense of the history as well as the economics involved, because he was local. And I believe that was you're going to have to forgive me. It's been a while, but I believe that was Las Cruces, mm-hmm. New Mexico.
Yes,
if I'm not mistaken. And he was saying, in 2014, the monument, when it was, pretty new at the time, brought in something, I believe it was $9 million into the local economy. And then that very next year, it had brought in $19 million in 2015. So, here we are, we can extrapolate. And he says it's only been growing and growing, even if we didn't have the exact numbers in front of us. So, you hear a lot about how, the locals hate these places, but it's not what I discovered. I found that most locals were really appreciated this natural wilderness still existed nearby them. They appreciated that it was bringing people in. The restaurants were being more populated. The outfitters and outdoor guides were certainly having more business. The only real resistance I saw was there are some ranchers who are afraid of losing grazing rights who've been grandfathered in. But the thing is that hasn't been the case in almost all of them. They're afraid that it could happen, but in almost every situation, if you've had your grazing rights in there before it was a monument, then you've still got your grazing rights. It's not like they're pulling the rug out from families, which is one of the criticisms that I've heard in the rhetoric on the opposing side.
One of the other monuments we've heard a bit about but haven't talked much about on this podcast is mm-hmm. Cascade Siskiyou.
Yeah.
Up in Oregon, and that we know is a timber play versus the biodiversity in the area there.
Right.
What struck you when you went through that area?
It is just absolutely stunning, first of all. They've got these incredible mountain ranges. And so just to give a little perspective, basically it's where these three different mountain ranges kind of come together in a way that There are two mountain ranges that are running parallel and one that runs perpendicular to it. And that one acts as sort of a land bridge between these mountains. So it's got it's one of the most biodiverse places in the country. You've got all kinds of different ecosystems coming together and interacting with each other. And you can really see the diversity in the rare animals that are there and in the plants that are there. And even in the terrain, there's something for your eyes everywhere you look. Really, really beautiful. And the Pacific Crest Trail runs right through it as well. I was surprised, honestly, when I heard that that was one of the ones that they're planning on reducing. There are a lot of trees there, and I'm sure they could be sold for profit. But, we have plenty of trees in other places that aren't so fragile and so precious to us. It seems like it'd be a tragic waste to have that place logged.
So I want to take a step back and talk mm-hmm. more about your just general adventures here, because you took your life on the road, you bought a van, and the monuments trip almost culminated, 2 years of that. Why did you decide to do the whole van thing in the first place?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of cliche, but, you know, I'd just gone through a big breakup and I was kind of reevaluating my life and taking stock of where I wanted to be and how I wanted to be living. And, you know, I'd been trying to stay in one place more for a while. And so I decided, well, what if I just totally uprooted? I'm already freelance, so I don't need to be at an office. What if I could somehow take this show on the road and just drive around and work from wherever I am and ideally find more stories from the road too? It took me about 6 or 7 months to get everything lined up for it. But yeah, I managed to get a van and add all kinds of technology to it, from, you know, solar panels for power and Wi-Fi and everything, to some bells and whistles like color changing lights and a safe with a fingerprint scanner and stuff like that, you know, just to, you know, make it a nice little home on wheels. But go ahead.
Oh no. What does someone need to think about before they, you know, sell all their worldly possessions, put it all in a van and look for sponsors on Instagram? How much planning went into this?
Right. Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't have any sponsors on Instagram yet, but if you're out there, sponsors, I love Pringles or whatever it is that you want me to sell. I'm just mostly kidding. You need to be comfortable with small spaces, and you need to be okay with hitting your elbows and your head on a lot of things frequently. You basically just have to make friends with discomfort, essentially. Mm. You know, this is actually a pretty cushy van as far as van life goes. I mean, it's quite comfortable, but even still, it's certainly not as comfortable as even a studio apartment, let alone one bedroom or something like that. You just have to be prepared to improvise every single day. So, you know, frequently I wouldn't know where I was going to spend the night or even where I'd be driving to the next day. And you have to figure out where you're going to be able to dump your holding tanks and when you're going to be able to fill up fresh water. And you have to find coin-operated laundries whenever you're out of socks. And, you know, it's these little details that you don't quite think of when you're glamorizing the whole van life concept to yourself, and gradually it's like, oh right, this is just kind of your usual day-to-day stuff, the mundane things that, you know, they don't stand out in your normal life, they still apply here just because you're in a van. You know, it doesn't make sense to just eat off paper and throw everything out, because then you create a massive pile of garbage. So all right, how am I going to do dishes? How am I going to keep the water? How am I going to keep the drains from getting clogged? It's an endless chain of figuring out the next thing that you got to figure out.
All right. So speaking of the next thing, I know you flew to Maine, didn't drive there. So you got to Katahdin, but you didn't make it to any of the marine monuments. Any chance you're going to get your hands on a boat soon?
I would love to. I have been to, so there, the Marine National Monuments were under the first comment period that we had to deal with, but then they expanded a second comment period in the Department of Commerce that included the same marine national monuments, but also added some marine national sanctuaries, including Monterey Bay, which is one of the most special places in the world, as far as I'm concerned, as well as Channel Islands in California and the Farallon Islands and several others. And I mean, I learned how to scuba dive in Monterey, and I used to go there as a kid and look at the Monterey Aquarium and try to see whales passing by on the coast. So I have touched some of those, and the idea that we could sell those to offshore oil rigs or cable laying or commercial fishing that could deplete some of these, you know, the one around Monterey is now the biggest marine preserve in the world, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. I think it finally grew larger than the Great Barrier Reef, which is also dying, incidentally. Yeah. So the idea that we could threaten the biodiversity there and these incredibly fragile ecosystems that we hardly know anything about in many of them. You know, like, for example, the Marianas Trench, the deepest place on Earth, is one of the monuments being threatened. And we've explored the moon vastly more than we've explored the Marianas Trench. So the idea that we could whatever's down there, it'll be fine, or it'll die, or who cares. That to me is just so short-sighted and really, really irresponsible.
So after having done this trip, you have now been to 14 more national monuments than Secretary Zinke had, if my math is right. So, yeah, if you got 30 right. seconds in an elevator with the secretary, or maybe President Trump at this point, since it's in his hands, what would you tell them? What's the elevator pitch of what you learned after 6,000 miles on the road?
What's the elevator pitch to Ryan Zinke? You know, you'd probably just want to shake him and try to, you know, I wouldn't actually shake our dear Secretary of the Interior, but yeah, I would want to know how he thinks he has the right to sell off these places that we've been custodians for as long as we've been here, and sell them off so at the hazard of future generations not getting to enjoy them as we are. You know, this is our American heritage, these wild places, and he's going to put them up for profit, for a very short-term profit. So I'd want to know who's pulling his strings, and I would love to ask him, you know, when he completely sold out here, because he likes to parade around on horses and show what a great hunter he is. But, you know, he's been avoiding the people who have been responsible for making these incredible places and protecting them. And I think it's just because he can't look them in the eye.
Brent, what is next for you? You selling the van or hitting the road again?
I'm splitting the difference right now. So I'm still in the van, but I'm actually planning on holding up in Los Angeles for a while, for a season or two, and seeing what happens here. Which is actually where I was before this whole van thing got started. But I have a few things in the fire. So we'll see if anything turns out. And if not, then I'll probably take off and do another lap. And if so, then I'll figure it out. But it still very much feels like an improv exercise where I'm kind of taking it day by day and seeing how it feels to be where I am and if I want to stay or if I want to go.
Sweet. Brent Rose is a journalist, filmmaker, guy with a high-tech van that he drove 6,000 miles to 22 national monuments in 3 weeks this summer. Brent, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We'd like to wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. This week, the last of the great Native American warriors surrenders. It was the first week of September, 1886, when Geronimo and his band of Chiricahua Apache fighters turned themselves into the U.S. Army in Arizona. They had evaded thousands of Mexican and American troops for over a year, but worn down and running low on supplies, they surrendered to Lieutenant Charles Gatewood, a West Point graduate who spoke some Apache and who Geronimo knew and respected. Geronimo was already well known at the time of his surrender. In the coming decades, he became a bona fide celebrity. When the Chiricahua Apache were moved from Florida to Oklahoma in 1894, tourists paid 25 cents for a button off his shirt or a hat from Geronimo's head. He kept buying new buttons to sew on and hats to sell on the train ride. He made the rounds at expositions and world's fairs, including the 1901 Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, where President William McKinley was assassinated. Geronimo rode on horseback at Teddy Roosevelt's inauguration. And a few years later, he publishes autobiography as told to the superintendent of education in Lawton, Oklahoma. Despite the fame, Geronimo was never allowed back to his home in Arizona. He died in 1909, still a prisoner of war. On his deathbed, he told his nephew he regretted his decision to surrender 23 years earlier, telling him, quote, "I should have fought until I was the last man alive." Geronimo, who surrendered this week in 1886. That's all I got for you this week. We have more on our blog about national monuments, national parks, and climate change. Also, a trio of really awful bills that just got a hearing before a House subcommittee. One of them simply an egregious giveaway of publicly owned oil, gas, and coal. That's all up at medium.com/westwise. Of course, we always love your feedback about the show. Send that to podcast@westernpriorities.org. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, maybe sooner, if President Trump either takes action on national monuments or releases Secretary Zinke's secret report. We still don't know what's in there, but head back one episode in your feed for a deep dive into all of that. Thanks again to our guest, Brent Rose. You can hear about his road trip at 27monuments.org. I'm Aaron Weiss. On behalf of all of us, the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.